Again, we're going to walk through the Analytical Chemistry Data Review webinar on volatile organics data as sponsored by the EPA's AustReady office for their Analytical Services branch. Your primary instructor is Charlie Appleby, who's coming to you from that Analytical Services branch, and he holds a bachelor's degree in chemistry from the California Polytech State University and has over 35 years of experience in organic analytical chemistry, quality assurance, and laboratory management. He has been involved in the contract laboratory program for data review, data quality assessment, and laboratory evaluation since 1988. And I think with that, I'm going to go ahead and get ready to turn things over to Charlie Appleby, your primary session instructor. Charlie, whenever you're ready to begin.
All right. Thank you. I can make sure I've got control of slides here. With that one. And I got my arrow. Good afternoon, everyone, or good day, whatever time of day it is where you are. During this webinar, I'll refer quite often to the National Functional Guidelines for Organic Data Review, which are currently posted on the US EPA's Superfund CLP website. I'll talk about review of volatile organic data, whether it's from aqueous, solid, or gaseous matrices. I'll speak from the context of GC-MS analysis. That's gas chromatography, mass spectrometry. But if your application is GC with other detectors, I hope that you still find the webinar just as useful. My arrows aren't working. In my approach to this topic, I'll generally not assume anything about your understanding of these methods. I'll try to take it at a fairly slow pace, and I'll pause after each section to take a few questions depending on how much time we have. And at the end, I'll try to answer the remainder of your questions. I'll begin with a description of the analytical system, similarly to my previous talk on high-res GC-MS data review, because I think that's important to have an understanding of the process used to obtain the data you're reviewing. The themes for today's talk are sample and data integrity and data quality elements. The technology used to separate volatile compounds from the matrix has come a long way since this unit was used, but the principle is pretty much the same. An aliquot of liquid sample is added to the sparger, samples taken directly from the sample vial in most modern units, and water is added directly to the sample vial for soil samples. A gas is bubbled through the sample in the sparger, or the sample vial, which then flows through a trap. If air is being sampled, the air is pumped directly to the trap. The trap's then heated and a valve is switched, so the trap volatiles can be desorbed onto the analytical column. Now, chromatography was invented by a Russian pigments chemist, Mikhail Svet, in 1903. I don't know whether he coined the term chromatography, but that would be fitting, wouldn't it? Modern chromatography came about in the early 1940s. So my opening question for you today, how many of you in attendance today have packed your own column for gas chromatography?
And while we watch for those answers to come in, we do have a series of interactive polls that appear in the lower left half of your screen, so they'll periodically pop up throughout today's broadcast. To participate into the poll, just simply click on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply. And it does look like those answers are coming in, and Charlie, from what I'm seeing, more than 80% of your audience have not packed their own columns for GC.
Well, that does make sense, since we haven't had to pack columns for GC since about 1985, but I'm seeing that about 18% of us have done it, so I'm very heartened by that, since I've also packed my own columns for gas chromatography. The separation and elution characteristics of a chromatographic column depend on the properties of the mobile and stationary phases and the interaction of the target analytes plus sample matrix that are introduced into the system, in addition to the length of the column. The injector plays a vital role, and there are many options for that step, which I'm not going to go into. The choice of detector is also very important because it provides the quantitative and sometimes also qualitative dimensions to the analysis. Hello. I'm not able to, there you go. Having trouble changing those slides, sorry. For methods to use GC mass spectrometry, the analyte dilute from the GC column, ideally at the same time, one at a time, not at the same time, and enter the ion source of the mass spectrometer. So here's an ion source where molecules leaving the gas chromatograph are bombarded with electrons, which break some of them into characteristic fragments and gives them a positive charge in most current configurations. These ions are then accelerated into the analyzer. So this brings my second question. Why do we then begin to describe the ionization products as M over E or M over Z?
For this particular poll, you have the option to actually type in your own explanation. There should be an empty box just below that question in the lower left half where you can type your answer in and then hit the enter key or use that looks like a box with an arrow pointing out of it button that appears to the right of that field. And as we see some of those answers pop in on the screen, we can scroll up and down and see how some of the participants around the webinar with you are sharing their answers. We do have almost 220 people who have already signed into today's webinar, so I think those answers are going to start to creep in. But we are getting some common answers across some of the submissions. So Charlie, have you had a chance to browse through and look at some of those responses?
Yes, thank you, Jean. And I see that I think the vast majority of you are saying that it has to do with the mass-to-charge ratio, which is what it is. We ideally want to get a plus one charge on these ions. We base our identification from our mass spectral library on a plus one charge. However, it's possible for some atoms or molecules to get more than a plus one charge, which makes them act differently. But we're going to proceed on the basis of a plus one charge, and we'll talk about either MZ or ME. I usually use MZ because it rolls off my tongue a little easier. So we'll proceed from the mass spectrometer, with the arrow on you, to the from the ion source to the mass spectrometer. In a quadrupole mass filter, the quadrupole is the component of the instrument responsible for filtering sample ions based on their mass-to-charge ratios. The quadrupole consists of four parallel metal rods. Each opposing rod pair is connected together electrically, and a radio frequency voltage is applied between one pair of rods and the other. A direct current voltage is then superimposed on the RF voltage, and the resulting electrical field affects the trajectory of the ions traveling down the quadrupole between the rods. Only ions of a certain mass-to-charge ratio will be allowed to reach the detector for a given ratio of voltages. The other ions would have unstable trajectories and would collide with the rods and be drawn out of the system by the vacuum pumps. This permits selection of an ion with a particular MZ, or allows the operator to scan for a range of MZ values by continuously varying the applied voltage. So let's stop and see if there are any questions regarding the instrumentation.
So as a reminder to participants, you can share your questions and comments for today's instructor using the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. Right now, I don't see any content-specific questions that have come in. So I think in the interest of time, Charlie, you can probably go right on ahead, and we'll come back to questions in just a few moments.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. So let's begin our data review process. The first step in data review is to conduct an evidentiary audit, or we could say to take a high-level tour of the data package. Find whether all elements called for in your statement of work or your quality assurance project plan are present. You may hear me refer to case narrative or SDG narrative or just CASE or SDG, and these are all contract laboratory program or CLP terms. SDG stands for sample delivery group, which is generally a set of 20 samples or up to 20 samples. And a CASE is, say, from a sampling event, when a sampling event yields a CASE of samples, let's say, and the CASE may have more, one or more SDGs. The evidentiary audit should help answer some important preliminary questions about the data. For example, are data present for all the samples that were requested? And to answer this question, you may really have to, when you go back to the chain of custody, you'll find 100 samples listed and there's only 20 in an SDG, so you'll really have to look at all the SDGs to verify you have data for all your samples. Were there problems with the sample delivery? There should be notes. There may be notations on the chain of custody or in the case narrative that we'll talk about in a little bit, or in other documentation in the data package that we'll also get to in a bit. Did all the samples arrive intact and properly preserved at the lab? And that information should be in the sample login information that we'll talk about. Was this lab actually the one scheduled to receive the samples? And if that was not the case, there certainly should be some communication in the package about, well, we got these samples, and some, if they reported the data, then they must have been reassigned it or something. Was the chain of custody signed? The chain of custody should be signed off by the sampler. The courier generally doesn't sign the chain of custody. Sometimes they do. And then it should be signed off at the lab. And this is evidentiary proof of possession. If custody seals are typically used to protect evidentiary integrity of samples, were they intact? And most labs will tape them on a sheet of paper, and they'll be included in the data package, usually near the back. If it's a hard copy data package, the lab name should be identified on all the documentation, and the pages should be numbered in case they get dropped or misplaced. We'll talk about the case narrative next. Laboratory correspondence, typically at the end of the package, may further document any logistical problems or attempts to get information. If the laboratory was to follow a particular approved method or statement of work, it should be referenced in the documentation, including on prep sheets and in the method used to process the chromatographic data, because they should have a standard operating procedure for how they implement a particular method. The case narrative should describe any problems with receipt and handling, with analysis and data processing of the samples, any deviation from the required method of analysis and reporting, example calculations, and any QC deficiencies. There should be a statement as to the completeness and authenticity of the data that's signed by the lab manager. This establishes that the lab has taken responsibility for the quality of the data. If a laboratory decides to quantitate an analyte using a different mass fragment, this should be described in the case narrative, and the calibration performance of the alternate ion should be documented as such. Yet we find upon checking that these things are done with no documentation, which doesn't serve to document data quality. However, they will go unidentified unless you look at all the pages in the package. CLP requires laboratories to provide a list of manual integrations in the SDG narrative. However, there are times when this list has been hastily prepared, and the reviewer finds that some manual integrations have been incorrectly completed, or at least not properly documented, such as sample IDs incorrectly listed, or omitting some of the manual integrations, or reporting a manual integration of a standard that wasn't included in the SDG. Sample calculations are typically generic like these, but they They would be more useful if they showed specific data from the package used to duplicate the reported results. Often labs introduce a slight twist, incorporating steps and not showing all of their math. So it's also very important it's very important that you can determine exactly how the lab arrived at the results they reported. And also that they should not round any results until the final, because that can introduce sources of error. Now the methods and most statements of work don't require this. You have to ask for it when the lab is hired. I hope you can see this okay. I can't see it very clearly on my screen, but this is an example of the types of information that should be reviewed with regard to the analytical sequence. This is a Form 5, CLP Form 5, for bromofluorobenzene, a tuned check compound. The reviewer should note the start and end times of the sequence and look for the QC samples and the proper sequence of data that are in sample injections that accompanies the tuned standard. So we have an initial cal here, we have a blank, we have some samples, we have a continuing calibration in blank, we have more samples, and we have a closing calibration. So that's the proper type of sequence that we should be looking for in these data packages. Review the SDG narrative to determine if samples were properly preserved and arrived at the laboratory in the proper condition. For example, were they intact? Were they at the right temperature, in the right temperature range? For example, below 6 degrees centigrade, but not frozen. Were there any air bubbles or detectable headspace in the VOA vials? Is there an indication of problems with the samples? If there is, then sample integrity may be compromised. The lab should include a table of pH values measured in preserved VOA water samples. These should not be checked in sample receiving. Verify that technical holding times have been met by comparing the collection dates and times on the chain of custody with the dates of analysis on the prep log or on your CLP Form 1. Verify for any TCLP, toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, technical holding times by comparing the sample collection dates on the chain of custody with the dates of bleaching and extraction on the prep sheets. And the prep sheets should be near the end of the package. Establish technical holding times by comparing the dates on the extraction sheet with the times and dates and times on your Form 1s for CLP. This slide covers trace volatiles, but I'll fill in some more information and also refer you to the National Functional Guidelines to cover the other matrices. Soil samples can typically be held under refrigeration for up to 14 days prior to analysis. Ambient air samples collected in SUMA canisters can be held up to 30 days prior to analysis. If the TCLP, SPLP procedures performed within the extraction technical holding time of 14 days, you can avoid qualification of data. If a discrepancy between the sample analysis date and that on raw data is found, perform a more comprehensive review to determine the correct date for establishing holding times. Soil samples received in coring samplers should have been transferred immediately by the laboratory to pre-prepared and teared closed-loop vials, and they should be stored frozen. But be aware of the actual sample vials that were shipped. If a lab is used to getting 5 grams of soil in a vial that they can freeze, or if they do the transfer themselves, store that in the freezer, and you send them a 40 mil vial packed with wet sediment, they may stick that in the freezer, and then it will, of course, break. Well, you'll have to get some more samples, I guess. Annotate the effect of holding time exceedances on the resulting data in the data review narrative. If samples are received with shipping container temperatures over 10 degrees centigrade, use your professional judgment to determine the reliability of the data and document the quality as best you can. For example, if the sampling site was 2 miles down the road, the temperature in the cooler may not have gotten down to temperature yet, or they may have sat on a loading dock somewhere. So you need to, you know, learn all the information about that cooler to make the best decision. Any questions about preservation and holding time?
Hey, Charlie. We did get a few electronic questions that have come in. I'll start reading through some of those while encouraging participants to go ahead and start typing in their own questions if they haven't done so in the Q&A window. This first question is in reference to electronic data packages. One of our participants would like to know if all of the pages in an electronic data package should be numbered.
I would say yes, they should be numbered. What most laboratories do when they produce a hard copy data package is they create the electronic one, which makes the numbering easy, because when you create a PDF, the pages are all numbered, and then they'll print that. And so their page numbering is done, so gone are the days when labs had to go through with a stamp and put numbers on every page. But I would say yes, because, you know, if you're in the middle of an electronic data package and there are no page numbers, oh, and say you had to go back to the case narrative and read something, how do you know where you are? So you really, really have to have page numbers.
All right, excellent. One of our participants would like to know if you could verify that soil or sediment VOC samples should be frozen prior to analysis.
I hedged a little bit about sediment samples when I described what was done in one case. Sometimes I can't use a coring device if the sediment is too loose. So labs need to be careful with samples that are really high in moisture content, and it may be advisable for them to inform their customer, which is you, I guess, and perhaps to proceed to analysis as soon as possible rather than trying to store them for any length of time. But samples collected in those coring devices, normal dry soil, and which are then transferred to a closed-loop stripping vial, or samples that are put in those vials in the field and you get them in the lab, those can be stored frozen. That's the best way to keep the soil samples, and they won't break if there's only 5 grams of soil in them.
Okay. And the next question we'll take asks, on page 13, the table says that a preserved sample analyzed outside the 14-day holding time could be biased in either direction. They want to know, how could this bias the results high?
It could bias results high if there's some kind of degradation that's going on in the sample. Say you had some dechlorination going on of a tetrachloro or trichloroethane or ethene into one that's, say, a dichloro, there would be more of that. So that would be a bias high result.
Okay, and we have just a few more questions we'll take right now. These are more baseline definition-based questions. So one of our participants would like you to define the terms R and J.
Okay, that's a good observation. I did not supply definitions for any of those. So let me run down through those and a couple of others. The R means rejected, and rejected data should not be used for any purpose. We see some of our EPA regents, when they qualify data, will put a value, like a value for detection limit, and then an R. And some data users find that to be confusing. Other of our regions, we just put an R with no result. And that, when you just have an R that shows up, there's not much you can do with those numbers. Now, a J means an estimated value. And we sometimes use a J plus or a J minus. The J plus means that there is likely to be a positive bias on an estimated result. And a minus, of course, means that there may be a negative bias on that estimated result. We also use a U qualifier for non-detects. And in the CLP program, we also use a C qualifier for mass spectral confirmation having been done on a GC run. We use a B qualifier for something that was present also in the blank. And when you get over to the inorganic side, I think there are a couple of other qualifiers. And sometimes you'll see laboratories use an X, Y, or Z qualifier for special circumstances. I think that covers the qualifiers.
Thank you. And we'll take one last question here. Again, a more baseline sort of definition question. Can you define detection limit?
Oh, that's a hard one. I don't think I have enough time today to really get into detection limits. We're just going to deal with quantitation limits. And in the contract laboratory program, we have what we call CRQLs, our contract required quantitation limits. So they're listed in the method, and the laboratory must modify them when they report a sample, depending on the actual weight of sample taken for analysis, and for soil samples, the amount of moisture that was in that sample, those kinds of things. But detection limit, I don't really have time to do that adequate justice.
All right, I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and close out this question period and move on with the presentation. You've got approximately an hour and a half left for today's session.
All right, thank you. I've got to kickstart my arrows again. Okay, now let's move over to the tune check. This is a bromofluorobenzene. Our review items would be in the CLP, the Form 5, which is actually the form that we looked at before when we talked about sample sequence. The BFB spectra and mass listing. The objective, of course, is to demonstrate adequate mass resolution and identification and show to some degree sensitivity prior to analyzing any sequence of standards or samples. And a sufficient amount of BFB is 25 to 50 nanograms in the detector. You should verify that the BFB instrument performance check is analyzed at the proper frequency and sequence. So it should be analyzed at the beginning and end of each 12-hour analytical sequence, unless, as it says at the bottom of this screen, a continuing calibration that meets both the closing and the opening criteria has been analyzed. In that case, in the CLP, the laboratory is allowed to continue to analyze samples without stopping to do a BFB injection. And the BFB should be analyzed prior to any standards or blanks or samples. The reviewer should compare the data presented in summary format on that Form 5 with the mass listing that's submitted with the BFB data to ensure that that it's complete and the right frequency has been met. The laboratory hasn't made transcription errors, that there aren't major differences between the mass listing, and if there are, more in-depth of the data would be required. A check to see the appropriate number of significant figures has been done and that they did not make any calculation errors in completing that summary form. Verify from the raw data that the mass assignment is correct and that the mass listing on that summary form, at least in the main column, is normalized to MZ95. Also verify that the ion abundance criteria are met. The critical ion abundance criteria for BFB are the ratios of 95 to 96, 174 to 175, 174 to 176, and 176 to 177. The relative abundance ratios of MZ50 and 75 are of lower importance for target analytes than they are for tentatively identified compounds or non-target compounds that may show up in the chromatogram. And their purpose is to demonstrate sensitivity at the lower end of the mass range. Get to slide 16, okay. Just a second. Now this is a auto-tune from a, this is from an Agilent GCMS system, and it demonstrates that that proper peak width has been obtained so that you have your unit mass resolution, and they've chosen a low mass, a mid-range mass, and a high mass. Now, who can tell me what those little peaks are after each of the big peaks? And type your answers in. I've got answers already. Some people are really quick. Somebody's saying that they are isotopes and isotopic abundance. They are not noise or interference, in fact. These are the isotopes of carbon. So in mass 69, there aren't as many carbons as there are in something of mass 502. So you see that small peak gradually increase, and what you're trying to show here is adequate separation between the larger peak and the small one so that you'll be able to see that M plus 1 peak in your samples. Thank you very much. Good answers. And I'm having trouble here. Okay. So this is the actual mass listing that appears on the Form 5. When I showed it before, it was too small for you to really see. And so this demonstrates some of the things I was saying about this isn't actually the table that's in that, that's on that form. There's another column on that form, but this demonstrates what the ranges are for each of the masses that are being monitored. And you see the 173 through 177 are really done relative to, not relative to 95. But the mass listing on the Form 5 starts by demonstrating, by normalizing to mass 95. And then over on the right side of that form, we'll see another one in a little bit. I'll show you that those other ratios are given. And here's a actual spectrum of BFB. And I don't know if your mass 95 shows up. Mine's not showing up. It's kind of gray. But it's right here. And don't be surprised if the mass of the 176 ends up being higher than the mass 95. It just depends on how the instrument was set up. Okay, now this shows the Form 5, the summary of information, and you can see on here now what I was talking about. These are all normalized to mass 95, and these show the ion abundance ratios relative to the other masses that are shown over here on the left. Now, the table below demonstrates something that we found. Now, the contract laboratory program has a strong quality assurance program, and we have a support contract called the Quality Assurance Technical Support Contract, and they provide data package audits for us. And one of the things that they found in one data package was the fact that whereas this listing on the Form 5 met all the criteria, in the raw data it showed this listing on the right, which also happens to meet all the criteria, but there's a discrepancy. We don't know really where the data that was reported on the Form 5 came from, but it disagreed with what was in the raw data, and so you would need to check that and make sure that it also complied. But this is the kind of thing that you come across when you look back into the data. Action to be taken when there are problems with the tune check depend on whether sample reanalysis can be done. In the event that samples can be reanalyzed, you should just have them do that. If they can't be reanalyzed, you need to examine all the calibrations associated with the sequence to evaluate whether proper qualitative criteria were achievable. If so, it may be possible to salvage usable data from the sequence. Otherwise, you may need to up to rejecting the data. It may have to be done. The reviewer should consider that qualitative criteria have not been met if retention times are not reproducible, in addition to a poor BFB check. Chromatography quality is degraded with poor peak shapes, inconsistent shoulders, or carryover. A valid tune check from the same instrument run at a different time might help, but if that's not present, then you don't have that option either. If the BFB peak was improperly acquired, too many scans averaged, or the background taken from the wrong place, the lab should be contacted to reprocess and resubmit that. If it's not an option, then the reviewer, you as the reviewer, are on your own to use your professional judgment and qualify the data appropriately. If mass assignments or critical ion ratios are incorrect in the tune check, check other standards to assess the extent of that problem, and data rejection may be the only option. Any questions on tuning, or tune checks, I'm saying?
We do have a question that's come in electronically asking if you could please elaborate on what tentatively identified compounds, or TICs, TICs are with respect to GCMS analysis.
I will actually talk about that a little bit more in depth as I get into actually reviewing the sample data. But thank you for the question.
Okay. Well, I think actually in the interest of time, we might move on, but we will take another break in just a few slides for more questions from our audience.
All right. Thank you, Jean. Okay, our next review item is the initial calibration. For this review, you need calibration summary form, which for the CLP is Form 6. You need the quantitation reports and chromatograms, and you may also need the, if the laboratory has included their standard prep log, in order to verify that the standards were traceable. And the objectives of this, of course, is to establish that the instrument is capable of producing acceptable qualitative and quantitative data. And you're going to hear me focus a lot on the way that we do calibrations for the CLP program based on RSDs. I'm going to try not to forget to talk a little bit about nonlinear calibrations, although I won't say much. You should verify the initial calibration was performed at the specified frequency and sequence. And essentially, an initial calibration must be performed when you first begin to do this analysis, or whenever the previous calibration is no longer stable, and the new initial cal must be performed. If you have spectra for the target analytes and labeled compounds, check to make sure that they are the right spectra, or match them to your own reference library if you have one. Verify retention times for each target analyte and internal standard or surrogate standard are within the specified criteria. If equivalent columns to those in the method were used, that's easy. If different columns were used, examine the quantitation reports to evaluate whether there are any unacceptable coelutions, particularly with regard to analytes that have the same nominal masses, or if there are multiple coelutions. On the recommended column for this analysis, only the meta and para-xylene coelute. So if somebody's using an alternate column and it's not that good, they really should change. If an alternate column has been used, the laboratory should have included sufficient information in the SDG narrative to evaluate the performance of that column. Ideally, a table of retention time windows, as well as information on the optimum resolution of closely eluting analytes, and a table of relative retention times. Also verify that the percent RSD of those relative response factors for each analyte are within limits. I would recalculate some of those RRFs and recalculate the mean RRF for at least one target analyte and surrogate associated with each internal standard, and verify that the recalculated values agree with laboratory reported values on their summary form. We frequently have to spend time verifying that numbers that appear in multiple places agree. Here is a chromatogram of a low standard. It's a good idea to check the lowest standard in the calibration to see if system conditions are causing problems with peak shapes or resolution, or if there is too much noise to really adequately integrate the peaks in the lowest standard. If no initial calibration was performed when it really needed to be performed, the data should not be considered definitive. And there, the only recourse may be to reject data. If the specified calibration concentration levels were not used, it may be necessary to modify the linear range for reporting. And then you've got to hear from the data user if you're not going to be able to report what they've got in their quality assurance project plan. If an otherwise compliant initial calibration was performed, but not at the specified frequency, you may need to qualify the results as estimated. Non-compliant ion ratios for any analyte, and I'm really talking about the chlorine isotope ratios that are easy to find, this may be cause for concern. There may just be interferences coeluting, or it may be that the mass spectrometer was not tuned correctly, or the ion source has gotten dirty, or other electronic problems exist. If there's a systemic problem resulting in failed ion ratios in the calibration, I would qualify detects and non-detects as rejected, and all identifications as tentative, or use that J for estimated value. And tentative identifications, we didn't talk about a qualifier for that. In the CLP, I believe we're using an N flag for tentative. We use it when we report ticks, so that's what I would use. If retention times are outside specified windows, qualify non-detects as unusable. Consider ordering reanalysis of the initial calibration and the associated samples. I'll go straight to continuing calibration. And here we'll look for the CLP Form 7 quantitation reports and chromatograms, and you may also need to look at that standard prep log. The objective, of course, is to document continued stability of the calibration as performed in the initial cal, and to make sure that it remains so throughout the analytical sequence. Pardon me, I just had one of those software upgrade patch things pop up. I hope it doesn't try to do it during the middle of our talk. Verify that the CCB was performed at the right frequency and sequence. It should be performed either after the BFB, or if it was also a closing cal, it should have met the closing calibration and the opening calibration criteria. Verify that the correct concentrations of target analytes and surrogates were used in the calibration verification standard. Verify that the response factors and percent D for each analyte and surrogate are reported on the Form 7, and that there's good transcription between the quantitation report and the summary form, and verify the calculations for at least one analyte and surrogate associated with each internal standard. Verify that your relative response factors are greater than the minimum for the method, and that the percent Ds are less than or equal to the maximum for that method. And the same for the RRF. If the minimum is 0.01, then your RRFs can be 0.01, but they shouldn't be less. A large part of the review process, as I alluded to a moment ago, is verifying the information upon which other decisions are made. There. Sorry, it didn't change. Having a lot of trouble with that. Here we have two process summary tables with the first 9 analytes of the calibration, of the continuing calibration. You see columns here for the relative response factors for the CCV, response factors from the iCal, calculator percent D, and the percent D limits. Right, and I recommend checking a few of those calculated values when you go through to just verify that they agree with the data that's on back in the raw data. I've seen pages like this that actually use values from the wrong iCal for evaluation. This table would normally have a header that includes information on which iCal it refers to, and when the CCV was analyzed, and what instrument they were done on, so you can cross-reference all that information to make sure that you've got the right calibration. So again, these are from two different CCVs, one opening and one closing. Now I'm going to ask you a question, and I see answers have already started to come in. Which one of these was done at the end of the 12-hour period, and why? Why do you know that?
And Charlie, just while we're waiting for some of those answers to come in, we did have a real quick request to define DMC.
And I will talk about that more in a little bit, but that stands for deuterated monitoring compound. It's what the CLP uses as surrogate standards in our JCMS methods. And thank you for catching that. I've got DMC written in my notes, and I've been trying to be careful about saying surrogate standard, which is something everybody knows. So we'll get to that in just a minute.
Okay.
So I see quite a few responses that have come in trying to tell me which one, and most of them, some of them are saying that you can't tell because we don't have all the information, and that's true. If I had included that header, you would be able to tell very well. But most of the responders agree with me that in looking at these, she's got it. I'm chasing you. Oh, now I got it. Okay, thank you. So if we look at the acetone, it's 24.4 here and it's 36 there. If we look at the Freon, it's 17 here and it's 26 there. This other Freon, the trichlorofluoro, is minus 3.5 here, and it's minus 14 here. So in this one, it appears that response is significantly degraded, and that's typically what we see when we go from the beginning of an analytical sequence to the end of the analytical sequence. So one of the main problems we see in data from laboratories since we began requiring this closing CCV is that the closing CCV fails, and it's really dependent on the matrices of the samples that were in the sequence. Sometimes it's impossible for them to get it to be within the limits without running dilutions or taking out some of the more contaminated samples. So that's a common problem that we see in the CLP program. All right, thank you for all your answers. We'll move on now. We'll try to move on now. Hey, okay. So if the CCV standard, that's calibration, continuing calibration verification, was not analyzed at the specified frequency in sequence, we call for professional judgment to decide how to qualify detects and non-detects, up to and including potential rejection of the data. If the relative retention time of each analyte and label compound is outside the specified limits of the method, again, use professional judgment. If the percent difference of analytes or labeled compounds are not within the QC limits, the data should be qualified as estimated. Okay, now we'll pause for questions.
Actually, Charlie, I think just in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and skip past this question break and keep moving on. We do have just over an hour left for the remainder of the material.
Okay, so I better charge on. Thank you. Okay, let's talk about blank data. So for reviewing method blanks, and when I talk about blank data, I'm referring to method blanks, I'm referring to instrument blanks, I'm referring to storage blanks. Storage blanks should be generated by the laboratory when they receive samples, and then they're stored with the samples in the laboratory and analyzed at the end of the sequence that included the samples. Of course, method blank is generated at the beginning of the analytical run and analyzed after the standard. Then you have instrument blanks, which are run after highly contaminated samples to demonstrate that the system is clean before running a potentially clean sample after. Then there are our field QC, including trip blanks, field blanks, and equipment rinsates. We evaluate depending on how the project leaders want those to be evaluated. Generally, we don't qualify data based on that unless they want us to do that. So we've got the form ones or the summary, the reporting forms for whatever blank we're looking at. For method blanks, we've got a form four, which includes the samples associated with each method blank. We also have the quantitation reports and chromatograms for those blanks. The objective, of course, is to show that the analytical system is free of contamination, or if it is subject to contamination, that we're monitoring for it and we can take corrective action. And that's what we expect our labs to do, is to take corrective action if the system becomes contaminated. So a method blank should be verified that they're analyzed at their specified frequency, and that form 4 may be used to identify the samples associated with each method blank. Verify that a storage blank has been analyzed at the specified frequency and sequence. Also verify the instrument blanks have been analyzed at the right sequence and after samples with high concentrations. And you should be looking also at the data supporting the reported results of any blanks to verify that those results were interpreted properly. There may be low-level hits that you find in there that the laboratory did not quantify, but that if those are are also present in your samples, then there may be some impact on the data. And you don't want to see blanks like these. This first one has a severe rise caused by column bleed. And in the second one, there's so many peaks in it. This is crazy as a blank. All kinds of target analytes present, all this peak tailing going on. You really want to ask the lab to take corrective action with these kinds of issues showing up in blanks. Now, this is what a method blank for volatiles should look like. These are just the internal standards and surrogates. And they look huge on the nice flat baseline. That's what we want to see. So if a method blank or an instrument blank is not prepared and analyzed at the right frequency, use professional judgment to determine if associated data should be qualified. It may be necessary to obtain additional information from the laboratory and record the situation in your data review narrative. Otherwise, a lot of these qualification results are related to where the blank result falls with relation to the contract required quantitation limit. And I have EDL in here, and I apologize for that. It doesn't apply to VOA data. This is kind of a leftover from my previous talk. There's no EDLs in VOA data. And in the case of gross contamination, you may have to qualify everything as unusable. There may be instances where there's little or no contamination present, but qualification is still appropriate, as in the case that I showed you with the carryover from some previously highly contaminated sample. Any questions on method blanks or other blanks?
We did have one question that came in, but this one is asking, is a closing CCV required when you're using internal standard calibrations?
Yes. A closing CCV will verify that your response factors are still valid, and because you're still comparing the percent differences that show up in your closing CCV with the initial cal. Even though we're using the initial cal and we're using the opening CCV to compare our internal standard responses, we're using the closing calibration to verify that it's still stable.
Okay, I think those are all the questions I have right now, but let's go ahead on with the presentation. We'll take another break shortly.
All right, thank you. Okay, next we'll look at spikes, both matrix spikes and what I'll call blank spikes, and you'll hear me say LCS for laboratory control sample, but I'm referring to the blank spikes in that case. So we need for this the summary forms for blanks, which is the form 3A for the matrix spike, and I believe it's the form 3B for the LCS or blank spikes, and of course the quantitation reports and chromatograms. And the objective of a matrix spike is to evaluate the effect of that sample's matrix on the preparation procedures of the measure and the measurement technology, and to document accuracy and precision associated with that sample. And we would like to say that it can be used to evaluate other samples in the data set. Not necessarily. Depends on how similar those samples are. And for the blank spike, we are trying to evaluate accuracy, and if there are a duplicate also, and the precision associated with laboratory performance of the method in a clean matrix. We should verify that the requested spike samples were analyzed at the required frequency. And also make sure that the laboratory didn't use a field blank or performance evaluation sample to do the matrix spike with. That could make some confusing results. Verify that the recalculated percent recovery and RPD values agree with the reported values on the summary forms. Inspect the matrix spike and duplicate percent recovery and RPD, and the same for the blank spikes, to verify that they're within the limits in the method or the limits. If the lab is doing a blank spike, even when there's none required by the method, my hat's off to them. I mean, that is a quality control step. And they are probably charting their recoveries of those in an ongoing precision accuracy study. And you know, that should be able to demonstrate to the laboratory that their system is under control. So that is a good thing. Verify that those spikes are prepared and analyzed at the right frequency. Check the raw data, chromatograms, and data system printouts to verify that the spiked analytes met method specified concentrations, and verify that the LCS blank spikes are calculated correctly and that the recoveries agree with the acceptance limits. If a blank spike is not analyzed at that right frequency or how they said they wanted to do it, they should say something about it in the SDG narrative. I don't know what the impact should be on your data review process, but I think I would note that for some reason they did not report that blank spike. Maybe a question to get back to the laboratory on. And as far as action for spikes, if they were not performed, you know, it may or may not be necessary to qualify data because of that. If you have surrogate standards present in your samples, that tells you a little bit about it. And you'll hear me talk about deuterated and monitoring compounds in a minute that add even more information. I think that it may or may not be necessary to qualify data based on whether or not a spike was performed. If it was performed, but at the wrong frequency, again, professional judgment should be the rule. Now, we recommend that performance limits be established for spikes based on the 95 percentile of confidence for qualified data, but also to establish another limit at 99%, outside of which you look at for positive results qualified as estimated, a J flag, or for the lower limit qualified as rejected. And typically that's about 10%. And the 95% percentile percent confidence range is in the range of 20 to 40% generally. At least that's been our observation. If the RPD, relative percent difference, of any spiked analyte is greater than 30%, I would use professional judgment to qualify data. That limit is only advisory, but still you need to evaluate that carefully. In the case of a percent recovery and or a relative percent difference failure in conjunction with other performance factors, that may be an indicator that the laboratory performance has degraded, and I would consider all those factors in my decision of how to qualify the data. Okay, now we'll pause once more for questions.
Again, Charlie, I think we're probably going to go ahead and skip through this next question break and just keep on going with the materials.
All right. Thank you, Jane.
Problem.
We'll go to surrogate standard spikes. For this review, we need the, for the CLP, we need Form 2, which gives us the summary of surrogate standard performance, the calibration summary information and quant reports, chromatograms for the QC and field samples. The objective, of course, is to monitor and gain information about method performance during the analysis of samples for as many analyte types as are represented by the choice of surrogates in the matrices, as well as blanks, in blanks as well as field samples. For the CLP, we use deuterated monitoring compounds, and these are, we use 13 for the volatiles method, and these are the 13 that we currently have. These DMCs were chosen based on their characteristics and availability and their stability, their cost. Current cost to a laboratory is about 90 cents per sample when you include all of the calibrations and QC samples that are also included in that sample set. Their chemical representativeness. Now, several analyte, chemical analyte groups are represented here. You have chlorinated alkanes, you have alkenes, you have substituted chlorinated organics, you have ketones, and you have aromatics included in this set of DMCs. Here is just the table part of a Form 2 that shows, the DMCs are all numbered here, but the first one's vinyl chloride, and it proceeds on around, shows typical recoveries, and it shows a blank and two samples in this set. Now, looking at this, so we're getting quite a bit of information. We're getting 13 data points for every sample in the SDG, potentially. Imagine this chart with 20 samples listed on it. I'd like to ask you to put your thinking caps on and tell me what else we possibly could do with the information we're getting from all of these surrogate standards. Okay, not getting too many responses here, but I'm seeing that some people have caught on that this could actually be used for monitoring precision. And I think that's right. If you had a set of 20 samples that had these 13 data points in every sample, and you use those data points to get a percent RSD, standard deviation and percent RSD, you could monitor precision in an entire data set, and it would be statistically quite robust. So that's just something to think about. It would certainly be a potentially a big advantage for those who are looking for precision metrics for the data. That I will move on. So for surrogate spike review criteria, check the raw data, chromatograms and quant reports to verify recoveries of those surrogate standards. Check for calculation or transcription errors, verify that recoveries were calculated correctly using the equation in the method, and that those values agree with those on the reporting form. Whether or not there are two or more analytes in a particular sample, use professional judgment to, when there are two or more analysis processes of a particular sample. Use professional judgment to determine which one is more acceptable based on things like your surrogate recovery, the technical holding times, whether each one of those analyses was within holding time, and comparing the target analyte results reported in each sample analysis, and other QC information such as the internal standards. Action here on DMCs and surrogates. If they were not added to the sample, then you have to try to determine performance in the sample some other way, and that may be difficult. If errors are detected in calculations, do a more comprehensive calculation check. You may have to have the laboratory resubmit the data after correcting that. With recoveries outside of limits, qualify associated analytes, considering the existence of interference that's possible in the data. If the surrogate DMC recoveries are less than 10%, I would qualify detects as low, J minus, and non-detects as unusable. With recoveries greater than that low limit, qualify as J, and non-detects as UJ, or J minus, I'm sorry. If the percent recovery is, and again, here I'm using that 99% confidence limit of 10%. I apologize, I didn't draw your attention to that. And then the limit that's above that, which varies by surrogate analyte. If any DMC recovery is outside the limits in a blank, special consideration should be taken to determine the validity of the associated sample data. The basic concern is whether blank problems represent an isolated issue or whether there's a fundamental problem in the analytical process. Okay, we'll pause again for questions in case anybody has questions about surrogates or DMCs.
Okay, we did have a few questions that came in electronically, and one of these is asking, how can an RPD be less than the lower limit?
What I talked about was establishing two sets of limits, one based on the 95% confidence interval, and one based on a 99% confidence interval. So the 99 would be more inclusive of data in the set. I think that's what you're referring to. So we have RPDs that are within the 95% range, and we may have some that are outside that range, but still above zero, recovery is above zero. RPDs won't be zero, of course, anything from zero on up. And I'm not sure what a 99% confidence interval for RPDs might look like.
Okay. We did have another question that asked for MSD qualifying. Only the source or parent sample is qualified. Is that correct?
Yes, that's what I would recommend, that only the unspiked sample should be qualified based on a matrix spike.
Okay. I think that's all the questions we'll take at this break, so feel free to go on.
Thank you. Okay, now let's talk about internal standards. And if you're using a nonlinear calibration model, you're going to monitor your calibrations based on the correlation coefficient. And you're probably not using anything like internal standards. So this discussion is confined to the way that we're doing it in the CLP method, which is a narrower vision than you have with 8260. But for using internal standards, the CLP has a summary form. It's Form 8. And we're going to review quantitation reports and chromatograms and the GCMS run log. The objective is to evaluate that those internal standards were recovered appropriately and demonstrate GCMS sensitivity and response. That those are stable during the analysis. This is a Form 8, and this shows three internal standards for the volatile organics, and those are chlorobenzene D5, 1,4-difluorobenzene, and 1,4-dichlorobenzene D4, and shows a blank and a set of samples. We look for the area to be in a certain percentage, and it varies depending on what analysis you're doing. And we're also looking, I didn't point out, we're also looking for retention time stability. So the internal standard solution is to be added to all samples and blanks at the same concentration. You should verify that was done and check the raw data, chromatograms, and quantitation reports to verify the retention time of the and area response of each internal standard compound. Verify that the area responses are within specified criteria as well as retention times. If they're significantly different, if the retention times are significantly different from that CCV or ICAL midpoint, I'd say more than 10 seconds, then the internal standard peak may have been misidentified or something happened that you need to look into. You should apply any actions to the target analytes in samples or blanks that are associated with a non-compliant internal standard compound. If there's reanalysis of a particular sample, internal standard response may help you to determine which analysis should be reported. So we're saying area response is less than 10 to 20% of the opening CCV or midpoint standard should produce a qualification. And area responses that are greater than that low limit but less than 40 to 50% of the opening CCV. And then the upper limit, and the reason there are these ranges in the table is because I'm trying to cover more methods. We have in the COP, we have a trace method and we have a what we call our low media method. So there's low media method is similar to 8260. Trace method is similar to 524. When you look at TO15, the error method, it has different criteria. So that's why this table has quite a wide range of acceptance criteria in it. And I'll pause for questions on that in case there are any.
Yeah, we did have a few questions that came in. And this first one asks, how do you know which volatile compound to qualify if a single surrogate percent R is outside of laboratory limits?
Oh, that's a good question. What we've done in the CLP is we have correlated surrogate compounds with subsets of the analytes in the method. And that correlation had to do with their chemistry. So we correlated DMCs with target analytes with similar chemistries. And also a retention time correlation. So if we had two aromatics present in the run, we would correlate the earlier one with retention times of earlier or aromatic analytes and so forth. So those are the ways that we correlated them. And in our statement of work, we have a listing, and it may be in the functional guidelines as well. I'm not sure of that. Have a table that correlates the DMCs with the target analytes. Now for 8260, you know, I don't know if there's a correlation. Somebody else would have to answer that question. There may be, there may not be. But I would correlate them based on chemistry and retention time. And the same thing is the case with internal standards, of course. We've correlated the internal standards with specific analytes, and there it's essentially retention time related, but in the semi-volatile method where there are more internal standards, we've been able to correlate them with chemistry and retention time. But it's basically retention time.
Okay. We have another question where people would like to know, how are the internal standards different than surrogates?
Internal standards are used in the calibration, and they are so used to quantitate the results in the samples, where surrogates are used to monitor method performance during the analytical run. So when you do your calibration, those internal standards, of course, are present in the calibration standards, and the relative response factors that are determined in the initial calibration are determined relative to those internal standards. So then we add them to the samples. We use that relative response factor to quantitate the analytes.
Okay, we have another question on MSMSD. This is a multi-state question, so I'm going to read through the full thing. The participant asks, if the point of MSMSD is to monitor the impact of matrix on the sample, and the assumption is that the sample for the MSMSD characterizes the site matrix, why would only the parent be qualified? Shouldn't the assumption be that the matrix impact would be the same across the site?
Well, wouldn't it be better if we had a matrix spike on each sample? Then we could be sure of that. But the point is that we don't really know the lab may have enough information looking at the samples to tell us whether they look similar. And looks aren't the only thing about similarity. We still don't know if they're chemically similar. We could make the assumption that the matrix spike represents the entire sample data set, and I've seen organizations used to make that assumption, but most do not make that assumption.
Okay, I think we'll go ahead and close out with this Q&A break and carry on with the presentation. You've got just over 30 minutes left.
Okay, I need to motor on. Thank you. Okay, now we'll talk about analyte identification or qualitative identification of target analytes. So we'll use in the CLP the Form 1s, the quantitation reports, and the mass spectra. And the objective, of course, is to qualitatively identify the analytes and to minimize the number of erroneous identifications or lack thereof. So for target analyte identification, we're going to review the extraction and analysis logs. And the reporting forms, process data and raw data, to look for reported analytes as well as non-detects. We're going to look at the chromatography to make sure that there were no peaks missed, that those that were identified matched the retention time in the standard, that where there are ion ratios to be considered, that they make sense, and any abnormal surrogate or internal standard responses. And when you look at the chromatogram and look at your surrogate standards, you see a humpogram like we saw earlier on when I showed you that picture of a blank, and then the internal standard response changes in response to that hump, you know you can almost predict that you're going to have issues when you look at the chromatograms. Verify the calculations of sample results. Of course, that's not qualitative, but we're going to look at the spectra, and we're going to check for transcription errors. Now, here's a result of, here's a sample in the example data packet that's posted on the CLUIN website. Now, this is a pretty busy chromatogram. It almost looks like that blank that we looked at earlier, but I assure you it's not. But it has a number of target analytes, and we're just going to run through some of the types of information that are included in this data package. And you should really look for these in the data packages that you receive. First, there's the quant report. This is page one of the quant report. And here's page two of the quant report. Note the various notations automatically applied by the lab data system. Little dollar signs, and these are for the DMCs, and there's asterisks on the internal standards. And over here there are Qs, and what those Qs signify is that those analytes did not meet the criteria that were put into the data processing method for ion ratios or relative responses. And that really can have to do with a lot of different factors. It doesn't mean that they were misidentified. Now here's an extracted ion current profile versus the spectrum of a target analyte. This is vinyl chloride. And when you look at this, you can see a chlorine pattern. There's one chlorine, and there's about a 35% M plus 2 peak. And there's two mass fragments here that have that chlorine on them. And over here, you have a mass 62 ion, and down below it, a mass 64. And now here's another mass 64 that appears in the same window. When we go to the next slide, here's chloroethane. Here's that mass 64 ion, and that's the one from the vinyl chloride. And so you can see that they maximize in the same, essentially the same scan. And for the chloroethane, you can verify the chlorine pattern. And here's a trichlorobenzene. So here you can see at the 180, there's a pattern for three chlorines. At 145, there's a pattern for two chlorines. And at 109, a pattern for one chlorine. And over here, those ions line up at the same retention time. So those are the kinds of information that you should be looking at to verify correct interpretation of target analytes. Now here, here is one of the elements. Let me back up and say that one of the elements of the CLP QA program is to periodically perform electronic data media audits. I think I mentioned that, of data packages from our laboratories. Those packages are generally chosen at random, and the laboratory is required to submit all electronic data files associated with the sample, everything down to the audit files, the audit trail. Our QUATS contractor has software, the same software that's used by the laboratories that's used to process their data, and the QUATS team uses it to verify that the data were processed correctly. So one of the things that they find periodically, and I want to show you. In this chromatogram, these big peaks are internal standards and surrogates, except for this one, which is a 1,4-dioxane D8, which didn't recover too well. They didn't process that peak at 19.99 or this peak at 21.94. And so Quats looked into that, and they discovered that the first peak matched 1,2,4-trichlorobenzene in retention time and spectra, and that the second one matched the 1,2,3-trichlorobenzene. So be on the lookout for unprocessed peaks in the chromatograms as you review the data. And that way, and if you find something like that, go back to the lab and have them reprocess those peaks. So in the evaluating target analyte identification, verify that the positively identified target analyte mass spectrum meets the specified criteria, and if not, examine sample target analyte spectra for presence of interferences at one or more of the mass fragments, and also the possible presence of co-eluting interferences. Verify the relative retention times of positively identified target analytes. Make sure that they're within an acceptable range, which should be about 0.06 retention time units of that analyte in the associated calibration. Be aware of situations when sample carryover is a possibility and use professional judgment to determine if that has an effect on analyte identification. Now, keep in mind an instrument blank should be analyzed after a sample containing target analytes that exceed the calibration range. And also non-target compounds. Verify that peaks are correctly identified as target analytes or non-target analytes that may be of interest. Verify that there is no erroneous analyte identification, as well as that there are no false negatives. Non-target analytes are a little more difficult to assess. And one thing that you may see that really is a false negative when you do the search for non-target analytes is a target analyte that shows up as a tick, a tentatively identified compound. When you see that, the laboratory should reprocess the data and report that according to their calibration. So here is a CLP reporting form. It's Form 1J, VOA tick, tentatively identified compound. It's a blank, and they have one unknown. It's actually at a fairly high value. It's very close to, it's above actually the CRQL, the contract required quantitation limit. It's well above it, in fact, because this is a trace VOA method, and the CRQL and the CLP for that method is 0.5, so this is well above the quantitation limit. This is the spectrum for that peak. I want to see how many mass spectral interpretation experts I have out there. Let's quickly pause and see if you can give me a possible empirical formula for this peak. And I'll just note for you that we have at 114, we have what appears to be a 2-chlorine pattern. At 79, we have what appears to be a 1-chlorine pattern.
And just a reminder, we do have those poll boxes popping up again in the lower left half of the screen. So for those of you who indicated you couldn't see the box before, you should now be able to see this interactive poll question. I know you can't exactly type in subscripts and superscripts in there, but you can do your very best to describe what the formula might be.
You don't need to tell me exactly how many you think there are. Just tell me what you think is there. You can type in numbers, that's fine too. And it's a little confusing, I have to admit. It's got carbon, yes. And I said it's got chlorine, so you know it's got carbon and chlorine. We can assume there's hydrogen.
That was going to be my next guess.
Dichlorobenzene. Well, it's not an aromatic, but it could be an alkene. And it's going to have how many? It's going to have three carbons and two chlorines. And as it turns out, that's really what it is. But the 114 and the 79 doesn't look right, because there's too many hydrogens in there. But in fact, what it is it's a deuterated monitoring compound. It's not one of the ones that's used as a DMC, but it's the cis isomer of the trans 1,3-dichloropropene, and it's present because it's an impurity in the spiking solution. So the fact that it's in there, in the blanks, it should not have been reported in the TIC reporting forms for the samples in this data set. So that's the upshot of this exercise. But it's interesting that this was present, and the library search that the laboratory did found possibilities, none of which really were given a high likelihood. I think the highest percentage of confidence was about 35. So the laboratory went ahead and reported it as an unknown. But in fact, it was just a contaminant in a spiking solution. So now let's move on to analyte quantitation. So we're going to again use that Form 1 and the sample prep log, the SDG narrative, and the quant reports, the chromatograms, and the mass spectra. And we're going to try to derive accurate quantitation for our target analytes. Verify that the results for all those positively identified analytes are calculated correctly and reported by the laboratory, and that CRQLs are calculated for non-detects correctly. That the correct internal standard and quantion and calibration factor are used to calculate those reported results. Verify some of those calculations. Verify that sample-specific CRQLs have been calculated, as I said before, based on the amount of sample present or the percent moisture in soil samples. If any discrepancies are found, contact, try to get the laboratory to reanalyze the samples or at least to reprocess the data and correct the situation. And note any reasons for data qualification in your data review narrative. Documentation of manual integrations is extremely important for organic data. If left unchecked, this practice leaves the door open for dishonest scientists to maximize their profit at the expense of data usability. Using the tools available to ASB's class contractors, we've been able to detect and pursue likely instances of improper use of manual integration and other data processing practices. However, careful eyes don't need the high-powered software that we happen to possess. Because you can tell, you can see telltale signs that something inappropriate is going on. Now, I'm not saying that anything inappropriate is going on with this data set, but there are a couple things that caught my eye, and I wonder if you can see them and tell me what you're seeing. Go ahead and type in what you think might be something to raise an eyebrow or two having to do with this report. Yeah, everybody's looking at that 2,4-dinitrophenol, and everyone's saying that it was integrated manually in too many samples, but I want you to note that all of those samples are standards. It wasn't actually manually integrated in any samples. I don't know if it was found in any samples, but if you have to manually integrate an analyte in all of your standards, why don't you change your peak identification criteria? If you look up at the phenol D5, you can see that that was integrated in a couple standards and samples, and some of the analytes were only reintegrated in samples, but most were integrated in standards. I'd say that there's problems with the analytical system, problems with the column or something that's causing all these peaks to be improperly processed by the data system. But just noticing things like this in this kind of report can lead you to ask some very important questions about the quality of data coming out of certain laboratories. All right. Thank you for your responses. We'll move on. Now, we're going to check qualifiers applied by the laboratory before finalizing data qualification. The laboratory will typically qualify analytes that are reported below the quantitation limit as estimated if we tell them to do so. And if they are doing that, they're reporting values between their MDL and the reporting limit. Of course, in order to use that MDL, they have to have done an MDL study, which we do require of the labs in our program. The amount of moisture in a solid sample may have an impact on data representativeness. For example, if there is more than 70% moisture in a solid sample. And depends on the nature of the equilibrium between the two phases, the analyte solubility characteristics as well. The reviewer should be aware of any local standard operating procedures or concerns of the data user and evaluate the data on this basis. If any discrepancies are found in the data, the regions or your designated representative to contact the laboratory should do so to obtain additional information that could provide a resolution to any issues. If discrepancies remain unresolved, then the reviewer must decide which values are most accurate and how to represent data quality and if qualifiers need to be applied. And as always, note in your data review narrative a description of the reasons for data qualification, and particularly if it affects a lot of samples. Note for follow-up action, numerous or significant failures to accurately quantitate target compounds. Apply appropriate qualifiers to the data, considering all QC criteria discussed in this webinar or in the functional guidelines. And it's also highly recommended that the data review process applied to all of these data be characterized for the benefit of those who might subsequently review or use the data. Some terminology and labels for communicating the stages and processes used for laboratory analytical data verification and validation have been developed by an EPA work group and are published as Guidance for Labeling Externally Validated Laboratory Analytical Data for Superfund Use. And this is posted on the EPA Superfund CLP website in the Guidance Documents folder. And with that, I would like to entertain any additional questions.
Okay, just a reminder, participants can continue to submit questions in the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. We'll go ahead and take a few additional questions here that we have in the time that's remaining. I'm going to start with one of the questions that was submitted earlier This participant wanted to hear a little bit about the difference of full scan and SIM or SIM methods.
Okay, that's another good question. Thank you. In the full scan analysis, as we described back when we were talking about the mass spectrometer, it cycles through the possible voltage ratios to bring all of the analytes in the range of masses that you want to examine into focus with the detector. When we do a SIM analysis, we have it dwell on specific MZ ratios to focus it on specific masses. And so you get more time spent looking at a specific target analyte, and you get better sensitivity that way. So that's basically what's going on when you do that SIM analysis. All of the other factors that are a part of the analysis, you know, the presence of your surrogate standards, the presence of your internal standards, if you're doing an internal standard calibration, can be accommodated. You just include those in the SIM experiment. And also, I know, and I haven't used one, but I know that there are instruments out there that can do both full scan and SIM simultaneously. I'm anxious, actually, someday to see one of those work, and you're all going to be laughing at me because this is not a new thing anymore. And I hope that answers your question about SIM analysis. But it does provide us with quite a bit more sensitivity than we get in the full scan method.
Okay. We have another question that came in, and they start by stating that there are multiple NFGs for organic review. Which is the most appropriate and under which condition?
On our website, on our CLP website, there are at least two that I can recall sets of functional guidelines for organic data review. And the one that I would refer you to is the most recent one, particularly if you are a client of the CLP program and receiving data under our recently awarded set of contracts. If you are not associated with a CLP, there isn't a great deal of difference in the data interpretation and qualification decision trees, decision matrices that are present in either of those functional guideline documents. And so I would say that you can use either one. Although I will say that as we go forward in time and our contracts that recently expired are no longer needed to evaluate, the data are no longer being evaluated, we may take that one down. So the one with the latest date is the one that will remain up there.
Okay, I'm going to wait to see if any other questions come in electronically. And while we're waiting, I do know that a few people indicated that they could only participate by phone today. So I will offer an opportunity here while we wait for a few additional electronic questions to come in. Those of you who might only be participating by phone, if you would like to ask your question out loud, I'll invite you to come off of mute on the phone system by typing in #6 on your phone keyboard or your phone keypad. And that should take you off the global mute. And you can feel free to identify either yourself or your organization and then ask your question of today's instructor. Remember, it's #6 in order to come off of mute. Okay, I don't hear anybody popping in on the phone lines, and that's okay. We do have another electronic question that came in. And this participant would like you to discuss the different levels of validation, for example, level 1 validation, level 2 validation, et cetera, and what items are typically reviewed as part of those different levels. They go on to say that some of the items described in the seminar, they think, are typically part of a level 4 validation only, such as recalculating the RRFs from raw data.
Yes, that's correct. We actually have another guidance document that gives, it talks about the staged electronic data deliverable, and it discusses levels of data documentation, as well as the level of, in terms of the level of information that's needed to make the decisions for which the data were generated. And so the lowest level is commonly referred to as a level one, and that kind of data is really just meant to provide the answers, just the quantitative results. I'll say quantitative and qualitative results. And that's pretty much it. In the next level, you get the QC data, recoveries, precision. You may get whether or not the calibration was valid, but you don't get enough information to verify the calibration. When you go to the level three, then you start to get enough information to verify the calibration, to verify some sample results and recalculate sample results. But you don't get, for example, mass spectra. You don't get the ability to interpret chromatograms. You may get an area report and a calibration model so that you can recalculate results based on that. In the level four, you get all of the data that was generated by the laboratory, including things like chromatograms, mass spectra, et cetera. And so you can actually reinterpret those raw data sources to satisfy yourself that the laboratory provided the best data.
And, all right,
and
excellent.
In addition to that, I should say that it's really economical, most economical for the review process to correlate with the data needs process. And some of our EPA regions have started doing this, where if you only need level one data, then you know that's the level of data that you should receive, and the review process is essentially a verification. And that depth of review follows through the different levels of data. So the reviewers can go in for level three data and verify those calculations for you and let you know that, yes, there is agreement and, yes, there were recoveries and we can qualify data based on the recoveries. And then for level four data, we can go in and verify that interpretation was done appropriately.
Okay. We have another question that came in electronically. Could you please discuss the proper target identification for samples analyzed using SIM or SIM? Most methods do not specify that ion ratios need to be established and that identification should be based on both RT and confirmation of ratio.
That's a very good point. Of course, for the SIM analysis, we do have retention times. And if the SIM experiment was set up properly, where there are ion ratios that we can use to confirm identification, they should be built into that experiment so that if you have a chlorine pattern for two chlorines, you can look at least a couple of MZs to verify that you've got a signal there and then you can verify that ratio matches up with what you would expect for the analyte. And so that makes it an even more powerful identification as well as a more sensitive quantitation tool.
Okay, I think we'll take just a few more questions here. In the interest of time, we are getting right up to that scheduled end time. So let me take one last question here. And this participant asks, would you expect a lab to identify in the quant report additional surrogates that the lab is adding to the method, blanks and samples, which it's not required for the specific method of analysis? For example, if they're adding 524 and 624 surrogates to a 524 method blank analysis, or would you tell the lab to stop adding these non-required method surrogates to the method blank or samples?
Well, I would be surprised if a lab is going to add a set of surrogates when it's not what they're being paid for, because it costs them money to do that. But, I mean, economics aside, if they told you what they did, maybe they have them all in one solution, which, again, doesn't make dollars and cents to me, but it's easy enough to interpret around it unless you're concerned with interference in retention times or something concerning the data that you want to get out of that. And in that case, I would say it's appropriate to ask them to separate them so they're only adding the set that's in your method.
Okay. I think since we have reached our scheduled end time of 3 p.m., Charlie, I'll give you one last moment to share any final reminders with everybody before I walk our participants through those closeout messages, including how they can share feedback and where they can access the materials that were discussed today.
Thank you, Jean. I want to thank everyone for attending today, and I hope that you obtained some useful information from this topic. My contact information is on the last slide. If you have any questions, feel free to send me an email with those questions, that will be the easiest way for me to know you have a question and respond. There may be some questions that also will appear on the website, and I will monitor that so that I catch those as well. And again, thank you all for attending.
Excellent. Thank you so very much, Charlie. I'm going to go ahead and walk through our audience with just a few final reminders before we go ahead and close things up for today. I would like to extend a reminder that you can connect with us on the Cleanup Information Network website at cluin.org. That's where we post information about these webinars, as well as a whole wealth of case studies, guidance, reports, and other resources related to the area of hazardous waste characterization and cleanup. We're also available on popular social and professional networking sites, so I encourage you to connect with us on one of these media to stay clued in to all of our new resources as we post them. As noted earlier, the presentation materials as well as a variety of other resources have been included on the links or resources page. You can follow the links that appear in the middle right of your screen under related URLs and click the link to seminar resources. Make sure you press that browse to button and it should open up that website. If you're watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow those links and pull up the resources from today's session. As noted, Charlie's contact information was already shared, so you can feel free to reach out to him directly if there were follow-on questions that we didn't have time to address today. I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form. I shared a direct URL to that right in the Q&A window. It's also available under related URLs. Please know I do read each and every one of your submissions. I do count on your feedback to help us to continue to offer these free online internet seminars. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can hop on the line and fill out their own feedback form. And that link is active from this point forward. So if you happen to be watching the archive version, you can still share your feedback based off the recorded session. I want to send my thanks to the nearly 250 individuals we had join us from all over the country today, including a few international participants from Canada and South America. So thank you all so very much for joining us. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. In about 1 to 2 weeks, you will receive an automated email with a link to replay or download today's session, and I encourage you to share that archive as soon as we have it.